My guest this segment is Dr. Samuel L. Blumenfeld, the author of NEA, Trojan Horse in American Education, The Whole Language OBE Fraud. Sam, I know that you have a book coming out soon that deals with public education and the criminality of it. And the reason I bring it up right now is because in hour number two today, I have a guest, Lisa Long, who has written a book called The Price of Silence, A Mom's Perspective on Mental Illness. And she had a son in the public schools who had various mental illness issues to the degree that he was acting out violently. Now, she's into this idea that the state should provide more services for the children of that nature. She thinks that there should not be a stigma attached to such situations. My stand on it is that if a person is behaving violently in school, I don't care why, whether they're mentally ill or not. In fact, if they're mentally ill, it's in a way worse. Then they should not be in school. What say you, Sam?
Well, I believe that no normal child should be in an American public school because the public schools, for example, have gotten rid of the Bible, and the Bible is such an important part of American history and American life and American culture. To eliminate the Bible from the public school is like you might as well eliminate the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. I mean, and to eliminate the idea that there is a God is so destructive of the spirit of children. Why do you think that there is this incredible increase in teenage depression? Where does it come from?
Yes.
We didn't have that depression when I was going to school. American children were, on the whole, quite happy. You know, we regaled the fact that we were a free people. Americans had everything they ever wanted. The most advanced standard of living in all of history. And yet today you have teenagers, high schoolers, committing suicide in places like Virginia. And why? Because the schools are void of any spiritual, meaning.
Recognition.
Recognition. There is no spiritual recognition. And so students don't know why they exist. They're told that they're animals like dogs and cats and that there is no purpose to life except physical pleasure. You know, enjoy yourself. And many of these children, particularly in the suburban high schools, are under extreme pressure to excel in everything, in sports and academics. And the pressure is so intense that some students are actually committing suicide. They can't take it. And that's because they feel this incredible sense of expectation on the part of everybody. Parents expect them to get, you know, A's. Their friends expect them to excel in sports. And so these kids do not dare fail. They cannot fail because if they fail, they lose everything. You see, because there is no God, they're totally dependent on what their friends and parents think of them. And of course, that causes incredible depression, increased drug use. And now you have whole books devoted to teenage depression, something which never existed in this country before. Depression only took on adults, but not teenagers, not children, and certainly did not lead to suicide. So I would tell that parent, with a child who is acting up, he's acting up because he's in an atmosphere that is so unhealthy. It's as if he has, as if he had eaten some poison and is trying to throw up. That's what a lot of kids are doing in the public schools. They're trying to throw up this lack of, not only the lack of spiritual meaning in the schools, but also this intensive imposition of atheism and nihilism on them, which they reject. And the only way they can reject it is by acting up. And, of course, you have a lot of people, a lot of children in the schools who manage to get through it all because they have a strong survival instinct, and half of this stuff goes in one ear and out the other. They don't believe anything they hear in school. They don't trust the schools. They don't trust their teachers. And they're not learning very much. As you know, we are producing an incredible number of illiterates and ignoramuses in America, young people. And that's because of what the schools are doing. And, of course, in my new book...
Sam, please.
In my new book, The Crimes of the Educators, I trace it all back to John Dewey's plan to dumb down America by changing the way children are taught to read. He wrote all of that in an essay published in 1898, The Primary School Fetish. And if you, it will be published in my book, in the appendix, the entire article.
I can't wait to read it, Sam. Tell your publisher to send me in advance, and I could write a blurb.
Yeah, just let me know where you want it sent. Do you want to
I mean, I emailed that to you, but I'll do that again. But, Sam, you know, one of the first questions I'm going to ask Lisa Long, and look, as a parent, my heart goes out to her, but is whether or not her son reads properly, whether or not he was taught to read, because I think that you're onto something when you point out that that's sort of the locus of a lot of the problem. And also that the idea of school shootings, the idea of violence in school to the degree that it's there today, this is not something that was the problem before, as you say. I'm not saying it never happened.
Yeah.
But, you know, this wasn't an epidemic, which is what it is now by medical definition. And there has to be reasons for that. You know, look, my own daughter is under these kinds of pressures at her school. I mean, this idea she has to excel and succeed in everything. And she has, you know, some issues with it. You know, she's gone and she's a believer. I mean, she's not an atheist.
Yeah.
But, you know, she's under this kind of pressure, and she's had moments where she's cursed out myself and her mother.
Really?
Just because of the pressure. Sure.
Well, that's it. You see, they are afraid to fail, you see. And
my response to it was that I've told her, do not worry about that. Just, you know, be there to learn, not to worry about whether or not, you know,
tell her not to worry about grades. You don't care, you know, if she gets if she doesn't get an A in everything, you know.
Because... Right. I mean, and I don't. And I've told her that, although my wife is a little bit more of a conventional thinker. I mean, she's into this, you know, you have to have an A. But I've told her that you know, I'm not concerned about that. I want her to have a good experience, and I don't want her to feel this kind of pressure. I want her to just be there to enjoy her studies and to learn, not to be pushed into, like, it's not a contest. It's not, you know, this isn't like a... You know, she should come out of the thing with some substantial learning, and the school is good. I mean, she's in a top school, but there is this enormous pressure, and sometimes she's really distraught over it. And I know they all are. You know, my daughter's not dealing with any emotional problems. She's, you know, fairly, but however society defines it, she's fairly normal. But this situation with the price of silence, this author. Her son was acting out violently, which I think is something that, as you said, Sam, it is a symptom of a bigger problem. in terms of the way we are educating our children and these methodologies of education. And by the way, I'm going to be doing a series with Charlotte Isabite, which excited about.
Isabite. Yeah, she's a wonderful person. I've known her for many years.
And her book is a deliberate dumbing down of American education. Very similar to your work.
Of America. The deliberate dumbing down of America. Right.
And but Sam, what do we do with this situation? Because now we have people, you know, who like Lisa Long, who I think is a well-meaning person, and others who actually are approaching me now and who are trying to get on my show, and I'm interviewing some of them, who are trying to tell us that mental illness is something that should not have a stigma attached to it, that it should be recognized as, you know, great people. And they feel that since society now recognizes gay marriage, this is the next sort of civil rights movement, that we now want to recognize mental illness as being, you know, as a people, I suppose, just like, you know, like Catholics and Protestants, we have mental ill. You know, it's like it's becoming the new special group, and that we should not view them with a stigma. And my answer to that is, first of all, if someone has mental issues and they're handling it properly, whether it be with medication or whatnot, and I'd prefer that they only use medication as an absolute last resort,
right?
Then they're functional, and it's kind of a personal matter. But if they are not able to handle it, and if they are violent, or if they are not able to function, then there should be a stigma attached to it. However, having said that, I don't know exactly what the answer should be to how to deal with people like that. I mean, what do you do with a child who's behaving violently in school, and the parents are insisting, and because we have mandatory education, the school has to take them in? I mean, I don't want my daughter, for example, to be in a class with someone who might be violent. And I don't care if there's a stigma attached.
Well, of course, you know, but also your daughter is in a school that has rejected the Bible. If you reject the Bible, you reject the Ten Commandments. You reject an incredible amount of history and a cultural foundation. The Bible is the cultural foundation of America. There's no doubt about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you start with the Puritans and go right through the 19th century, when the Bible was read by everyone.
All right, Sam, we're going to be right back. We're going to take a brief break. Sam Blumenfeld is my guest. We'll be right back. Statistics will show has increased over the past decades, maybe since the 1960s and moving up.
Well, yes, and it's because of the destruction of the spiritual, the spiritual nature of the human being. You see, they destroy that, you know, and you're being very gallant about your daughter's reactions to you. I mean, the fact that she's acting up against you and your wife is an indication that something is going on in that school that is affecting her belief system. And don't be surprised.
Oh, I know this.
Don't be surprised. If the conflict that is going on in her, because, you know, her teachers, she respects her teachers, and she's beginning to think that they are smarter than you and your wife. You've got to be very careful.
No, I know, Sam, and you're absolutely right. And my daughter knows all about the change agents. Don't forget, she is my daughter.
Well, I know,
we're very close.
Yes, but you have to realize.
But yes, it is, I am concerned about it, and I've tried to inoculate her to it as best I can. She knows what she's seeing, and she's very conservative, by the way, and she keeps that kind of quiet.
Well, good.
But yeah, it's an issue.
Let me read you something from my book. It's on suicide, teenage suicide. Sure. On Wednesday, February 26, 2014, that is just earlier this year, 15-year-old Jack Chen, a sophomore at Woodson High School in Fairfax, Virginia, walked to nearby railroad tracks and stepped in front of an oncoming commuter train, ending his life. Jack, captain of his junior varsity football team, seemed to have everything to live for. A loving family, a 4.3 grade point average, lots of friends. He had dreamed of becoming a computer science professor and having children. But at 15, according to the note he left behind, he couldn't keep doing this. He wrote, quote, "There is too much stress in my life from school and the environment it creates. Expectations for sports, expectations from my friends, and expectations from my family." He ended with a simple goodbye. So you see what that can do to a person with all of these expectations now. You see, the children who can read, the children who are considered the gifted ones because they can read, are under far more pressures, expectations, than the functional illiterates who are, you know, sit in the classroom and don't learn very much. The functional illiterates usually don't commit suicide. They just think they're stupid. But the very bright ones are under such incredible expectations that this happened to this particular youngster. And what I am saying is that this sort of thing goes on all the time. Not all of them commit suicide, you know, but it leads to depression, if anything else. And we have to be aware that what goes on in the public schools today, the atmosphere, the nihilistic atmosphere, is driving many of these kids to the edge, especially the intelligent ones. That's why I say you have to watch out for your daughter, because she's intelligent, and she is aware of what's going on, but I hope she can fight what they're trying to do to her in that school.
Yeah, I know, and her school is, you know, it's an exam
school. It's the
best. And it's highly achieving students.
Right,
And, I mean, she's, you know, I'm trying to keep, you know, a balance for her as best I can, but... you know, she does go through periods where she's feeling this kind of pressure. And
have you thought of putting her in a Jewish high school?
No, she loves the school, and the Jewish high schools are awful. They're very, you know, they're not good. You know, talk about atheist. I mean, she was there, and that it's not what you think.
I see.
We're not talking about. You know what I mean? They're not Torah based. I mean, they claim to be, and they might genuflect a little bit in that direction, but we're talking about left wing, you know, atheistic, you know, secular, morally relativistic, evolution based places. All right, we'll be right back.
It's frustration because ADD and ADHD are, from my point of view, are caused by the intense frustration that the look-say reading system produces. And that might be the problem.
Right.
Teach them to read in the proper phonetic way, you know, and that might even...
Well, apparently he's actually, according to this book, he actually is a very good reader.
Yeah.
I mean, he reads voraciously. He's read the whole Harry Potter series, and he's... you know, so I don't know if he learned phonetically, but
that's not the problem. Maybe it's God knows what the problem is, but he should be in psychoanalysis where he can just talk about what's going on inside him. You know, that's when you're on the couch, you're supposed to freely associate and
right.
Maybe he doesn't have a chance to express what the heck is going on inside him. Maybe he doesn't want to reveal it to his parents, but he might be able to reveal it to a psychoanalyst. Who knows? But one thing that I believe now, after reading about this youngster who committed suicide and was under so much pressure, that what he really needed was a year off school. You know, that ought to be a new practice, that when children start behaving and beginning to feel intense pressure, that they should have a year off of school and to be able to spend a year finding themselves, finding out what they're interested in, what they want to do, what they feel about doing, and not what they're being pressured to do. And I think that would help a great many of these students who sort of feel trapped. That's the horrible thing, if you feel trapped, you know, from day one, from kindergarten up into the middle of high school, and you have no freedom. You haven't been able to really express yourself because you're so afraid of failing that you run yourself ragged. Why not have a year off, say the sophomore year or the junior year, or to be a year off so that the human being, the young human being, can more or less find himself or herself. I would have recommended that to this youngster instead of being pressured to the point where he was committed suicide.
Yeah, you know, Sam, in the case of this a student that is violent in school and is committing acts of violence and threatening other students and teachers, you know, it makes me think, I mean, is it really necessary for them to be in school at all? They if they are at the point where they cannot be properly functioning in, you know, they hate school so much, they cannot be functioning in a classroom with other people. I mean, I think that if we look back in history a little bit here, maybe go back to American colonial times or you know, the 19th century, a person like that who really hated school and who couldn't be in school and didn't behave to the degree that it was so disruptive, they would simply be taken out of school and they would become apprentices in mentally ill and who cannot function for various reasons inside the school, who are violent. Sam, I would suggest that we look at an apprentice-type situation where they could be basically put to work at a trade, which I think would be good for them psychologically. I don't know this. I'm not a psychotherapist. But I would imagine that a young person who cannot function socially in a classroom and who cannot deal with the pressures of academics or all the other pressures, they could go to work for like a carpenter or a plumber or an appliance, you know, someone who fixes appliances, or a computer company, doing some kind of simple work, something that doesn't require a lot of mental investment, something that is repetitive, and something that can give them a sense of accomplishment, that can give them a sense of worth, that they can get paid to do. They can have some calm where they can sort of straighten out their life because of the simplicity of it. They don't have to have a lot of interaction with other people. That combined, perhaps, as you say, with a therapist. And I would think that a person could find themselves in a functional situation where they can then eventually, maybe years down the road, decide to go back into academics or maybe advance within the trade. Seems to me that that's how it used to be done. That's how it was probably done in colonial times, I would guess. What do you think?
Oh yes, you know, in colonial times, you didn't stay in school until the age of 18. I mean, you left school much earlier. Once you learned the basics, you know, reading, writing, and arithmetic, and a few other skills, there was no reason to remain. You see, another thing that the progressive have done is that they've prolonged adolescence. You know, in the old days, if you were 15 years old, you were practically considered an adult. You know, but the idea that we keep kids in school from age 5 until 18, you know, that is ridiculous. It's overkill, educational overkill. And of course, they have to fill all of this time with something, and they're not doing a very good job. You know, when I was working for a private school for children with...
Thanks a lot, Sam Blumenfeld's here. Sam, talk about, continue on with your experience working with emotionally troubled young people.
Yes, well, in that school, we took in every child who had a problem, and there was one black a child who was the most literate, most intelligent, and yet the most violent. You see, so you really can't, blame violence on the lack of being able to read. I mean, this boy was right. A very highly intelligent, highly literate individual, but was an absolute danger to everyone around him. And he was in the school for a short time.
What do you do with that? I mean,
he was in the school for a short time, but they had to eliminate him. They couldn't handle him.
Yeah. I mean, I would think that anyone who has a known propensity for violence or a record of violence, they should not be in the school. It's just that simple. I don't want to see my child and the children of other people, for that matter, teachers or anyone else, put at risk. I mean, if we had had a policy like that, maybe these shooters wouldn't have been in the schools.
Right.
I mean, it's just they don't belong in the school, period. Now, what happens to them outside the school, that's why I'm bringing up this idea of apprenticeship. I mean, I'm not saying this to be kind of to try to be harsh. I mean, it's just that I don't care why a person is violent, whether it's because they're mentally ill or whether they're just consciously. They do not belong in school, period. I mean, yeah. I mean that, you know, it's just that simple.
I suggested, some of these highly intelligent kids who are, you know, under intense pressure should have a year off from school also.
Yeah,
and they should
sure,
be able to
perhaps.
Pursue their own, you know, desires. They don't have to be an apprentice to any specific trade. What they can do is do something inventive, like creating their own little newspaper or creating
right, okay.
a service that they themselves enjoy performing. But I think that the pressure in the elite schools is so intense now that's the reason why we're having more of these suicides. And my solution is to give these kids a year off. I mean, if they've been in school since the age, you know, since preschool, age of five, right up to 18, mm-hmm. that's an awful long time to be trapped in that institution. And it would be good if they had a year off of, you know, out of prison. A year out of prison,
yeah.
so that
no,
they
you
can
know
pursue
something,
their
Sam,
own ideas.
It occurs to me that what you're suggesting would be a major threat to our education establishment. Because,
well, of course,
if you're going to let them take a year off, like, for example, this kid who invented Tumblr. I don't know if you know about this. He dropped out of high school. I think he had troubles in high school. He went on to invent Tumblr. He was a very bright kid, and he sold it to Google for $4.5 billion.
No kidding.
Right?
Wow.
Yeah. So,
well, that's what I mean.
He dropped out of high school.
Yeah,
but maybe this would happen. I mean, you get somebody out of high school who has, like, maybe if they can present some kind of a plan for a year of something they want to do. In this case, he created a website that, again, it was sold for an incredible amount of money, and he still runs it, even though he got the money. But, you know, that would be a big threat. And, you know, in today's world, with technology being what it is and computers, you know, maybe the schools are worried that they could be viewed at some point as not necessary any longer.
Well,
You could
argue of that until the cows come home, you know, whether schools are needed or not. But the society thinks that it needs a place where they can put the young people so that the older people can go to work. You know, if you can't take care of these kids, somebody's got to do it for you. But at least when I was going to school, we learned things that were useful. I mean, I learned touch typing in junior high school. So that that led me into a field where typing was necessary, you know, like in the book publishing business, where I could type out reports and reviews. And that's one good thing. And also, schools were thought necessary for back in the old days for scholars who were going to pursue scholarly pursuits. But now, today, we use the schools to just as a system, like, you know, making baloney. You know, all you do is go through the system and come out.
Sam, we're looking forward with bated breath to read your book.
Okay.
And to comment on it.
Okay. Send me your address and by email.
I just did.
And I'll make sure you get a hard copy. Okay?
I just did. Please send it to your publisher because I want to read it for my own sake, and I would like to write a blurb or something.
Great.
Sam, talk about – we only have a few minutes left, so let people know how they can get more information about your writing, your books, Alphaphonics.
Yes. Well, it's important for parents to teach their children to read with intensive phonics, and they can do that with Alphaphonics, which was written to enable parents to do just that. You don't have to be a certified teacher to be able to teach a child to read in the proper phonetic way. And my Alphaphonics book is available at Calcedon Store. Calcedon is spelled C-H-A-L-C-E-D-O-N, Calcedon Store. Just go to that website. And also, they also sell several of my other books, including Revolution Via Education, The Victims of Dick and Jane, and How to Tutor, which is a new updated version of my book that's been in print since the 70s, How to Tutor, which enables a parent to teach a child reading, cursive writing, reading by phonics, cursive writing, and basic arithmetic. It's all in one book. That's all the parent needs to be able to teach a child those three subjects for the first 3 years of academic education. Thanks, Chuck, for giving me the opportunity to be on your show, and hopefully we'll
thank you, Sam.
Be again. We'll be together again next week.
Thank you very much, Sam. We shall be, God willing.
Thank you.
And I appreciate your insights. Thanks a lot. Okay, you're listening to the Information Radio Network. Chuck Morse, by the way, you can check out my books on Amazon and Amazon Kindle. Thank you very much. Hour number two of Chuck Morse Speaks, Monday through Friday, 10 till noon Eastern Standard Time, here at the Information Radio Network. You're welcome to join the program, 844-439-1391. My guest is Lisa Long. She's the author of The Price of Silence, A Mom's Perspective on Mental Illness. She's an author, educated, mental health advocate, mother of four children based in Boise, Idaho. Lisa, you came to prominence with a letter that you published online after the Sandy Hook massacre, where you said, "I am Adam Lanza's mother." Lisa, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Chuck, thanks so much for having me on the program. It is Liza with a Z, like Minnelli.
Thank you very much. Liza, you... you know, your story is one of your defense of and advocacy for your own mentally ill son, who had a form of mental illness that included acting out violently. You point out, and I think accurately, that there has been a growing number of such cases in the United States, probably in other countries, in recent decades. I guess that my first question to you is, why do you think that this is happening? Why is it a situation where so many young people are not only mentally ill in that they're acting out violently, but there's also been an increase in suicide, there's been an increase in serious depression? What is going on in our society that these situations have become virtually epidemic?
That is a great question, Chuck, and it was certainly a question I wanted to answer in writing the book, since it affected not only me personally, but as you said, so many other people. If you look at the National Institute of Mental Health's website, for example, you'll learn that one in five children during the course of their lifetime will be diagnosed with a serious and debilitating mental disorder. That's a lot of kids, and that means that this is everyone's problem. Even if your child isn't the one who has mental illness, it's very likely that your child's classmate may have a serious and debilitating mental disorder. So it's a huge problem for our society. When you ask what the causes are, I think we have to say it's complicated and we're still trying to understand more. And there's a lot of research being done in the area. We know that, for example, genetics are a factor. We know that environment is a factor. We know that parenting is a factor, and poverty also plays a role. So it's a very complicated issue when we look at the increase in numbers that we're seeing.
Well, I think that, however, I'm specifically asking why it is, and I don't know if I'm off on this, but I think statistics bear it out, why it is that this has become a growing epidemic. I mean, we've always had poverty. We've always had genetics. That hasn't changed. But there's something that's happened in our society, and I mean, the obvious specific example is the epidemic of school shootings and school murders. You know, it's not that it never happened before, but I think that starting maybe in the 1980s, it has become an epidemic. It was not the case previously where people would show up at school and murder their classmates. There's something that seems to have changed, and I'm trying to look at this scientifically. You know, when you have an epidemic, you examine changes that have occurred with an eye toward correcting them. And there is some reason why we're having such an increase in these situations. Do you have any insight on that?
I do. I mean, again, I this is something that I studied in the book, and I have to stress, first of all, Chuck, that these mass shootings that you talk about are rare outlier events. Because of our connectedness through the media, it seems like one's happening every other day, which one is, but we're so connected to those stories, they're very rare. Most children are not in danger when they go to school. The real danger you mentioned earlier for kids who have mental illness is suicide. So between the ages of 10 and 24, it's the second leading cause of death for kids and young people. 4,600 kids lose their lives when they die by suicide. When you ask about a simple cause and effect, though, I think that's just too easy of an answer. But one thing we can look to is how we've chosen to treat mental illness in our society today. So we made a decision as a society to close so-called mental institutions. And that might have been a good decision in some ways because they weren't the greatest places in the world. They weren't providing the best treatment. But we used to keep people who had mental illness and mental disorders away from our society. We had them in mental health institutions. Those institutions closed, and they weren't replaced by community care. What they were replaced by is prison. And that's people in the mental health community have known this for a long time. People were shocked when I said that I had to charge my son with a crime to get mental health services, but that's true in my state and many other states.
Right. No, I agree with you. It's not right to put children in prison, and that there should be some sort of a mental health facility to put them in that maybe that has some oversight. And we don't necessarily want to go back to the days of Titicut Follies here in Massachusetts, where I am.
Exactly. We don't want to go back to those days.
Yeah, but no. But at the same time, I don't think it's anecdotal to suggest that there has been an increase in this phenomena. You know, you talk about the suicide rate. It has soared since the 1960s. And as far as school shootings are concerned, yes, it is rare. But it's actually, I think, a little bit more common than the media does report. I mean, there are cases locally here in Massachusetts, and I'm sure that there are local cases elsewhere where there have been school murders, but they're not covered nationally. They're covered locally, and they don't always involve guns. I mean, they can involve, you know, knifings and poisons. And it seems to me to be a problem that has proliferated. It is a new phenomena. So there is something going on here that is causing it. You know, we could talk about, to my way of thinking, the mental illness is only the symptom of a bigger problem. It's a symptom of something going on in society. Now, I'm not here to say that I know what it is, but, you know, I think we have to look at that and ask what's going on.
Well, I think we'd have to be careful, though, because one of the things, as a mom of a child who has a brain disease, it's really clear to me that my son's violent behaviors are a symptom of his brain disease. And in fact, when he's treated, he's just as safe and as great as any other kid. And so I think what we really want to focus on when we look at that question, sure, we can search for causes all day long, but what we really need to look for are solutions. I think, Chuck, I think you'd probably agree. You know, we clearly have an epidemic. We clearly have a problem, and we need to find better ways as a society to solve this problem. Frankly, it's costing us a ton of money, and I don't want to reduce this down to the question of money because obviously lives are more important. But, you know, if you just looked at it from a taxpayer standpoint, we're spending $80 billion on prison. That's a lot of money. And, you know, then when you look at people who have mental illness, if they don't go to prison, then they're on disability. It's really costly to our society. And families,
yeah,
just to
absolutely.
Get treatment for their kids, it's incredibly costly. So I think we can do better as a society, and we need to look at those solutions.
Now, you say that that your child at this point is being properly treated and that he's fine under the treatment he's getting. And I guess that my question to you is, what is the nature of that treatment? I mean, is this something – I mean, I would hope that somebody who has mental illness, who's particularly if they're violent – would be seeing a therapist and would be getting the necessary treatment, because I think it is treatable. So,
it is very, you're right.
How is that done?
Yeah. That's why we stress treatment before tragedy, right? In my own son's case, and so many families go through this, it took 9 years to get a diagnosis that was the correct diagnosis. So he had tons of different diagnoses, from ADHD to oppositional defiant disorder to autism spectrum. But finally, when we landed on bipolar disorder, we knew how to treat the illness. And so it really was as simple as putting my son on lithium and, of course, the support team of both talk therapy and occupational therapy, which really helps him. So just that combination of treatments, and when he was diagnosed finally in May 2013, started lithium. He's had no violent episodes, threats of harm to self or others in 18 months. He's back in a mainstream school, making friends, planning on college. 2 years ago when I wrote that blog post, I did not think that would ever be possible for my son.
So, no, that's encouraging. That's a positive story.
It is encouraging.
And that I would hope that our psychiatric community could do a better job of giving the proper diagnosis quickly, especially if someone's violent. Because, as far as I'm concerned, if someone is acting out violently, they should not be in school. Period. I mean, I don't want them there with my daughter. I mean, I just don't want teachers putting anyone at risk. So, you know, I would suppose that I would hope that they're pulled out of school and then diagnosed properly and quickly so that they can get the treatment they need so that they can go back into the school.
Yeah, it's that quick part of the diagnosis that really seems to be the hang-up for us. It's so hard to even get in to see a psychiatrist, especially a child psychiatrist. Some families report 2-year wait times. I know for me it was 8 months. So it's really, really hard even to get that treatment when you recognize there's a problem. That's why I wrote that I'm Adam Lanza's mother. Nancy Lanza wanted treatment for her son. She did not want her son to grow up and kill first graders. No mother wants that for her child. But the treatment and the options and the supports just weren't there. And they're still not there 2 years after Newtown.
Well, you know, it doesn't seem to me to be all that difficult a thing for our very well-financed system of education to deal with. If you have a student in the school who is violent, and if they do prove to have mental illness, then you take them out of the school, you get them diagnosed and treated, and then when they're ready, you bring them back in. I mean, I don't see why that is such a major thing to get over. I mean, we spend I don't know how many thousands of dollars per year per student as it is. I mean, it would save. It's not even a matter of money. It's a matter of getting people help.
Yeah, let me give you a shocking statistic that's in the book out of some research I did in California. So if you put a child in juvenile justice system, which is where a lot of kids who have mental illness end up, it costs about $180,000 a year to take care of that child. California spends around $9,000, I think. I'd have to check that, but around $9,000 on their kids per pupil per school year. That's a huge potential cost savings if you could diagnose kids properly. But back to your question of why is that such a hard thing? Such a hard thing because we're still relying on symptoms. You know, if you have strep throat, right, you go to the doctor and he does a throat swab, but we don't have a throat swab or a brain swab for ADHD or for bipolar disorder. A lot of times it depends on symptom diagnosis. And you could go to one psychiatrist and get one diagnosis, go to another one and get a completely different diagnosis. I lived that for 9 years.
Mm-hmm. You know, the other factor is that I think it ought to be acknowledged that school is not for everybody, that you could have someone who just isn't going to get along in school, who is going to be frustrated, who's going to be feel like they're trapped in a prison. I think even, you know, most average students feel that way from time to time. My daughter certainly does. And for that reason, yeah, I mean, and for that reason, is there might, I know there are social taboos connected to this. There shouldn't be. A person should just be pulled out of school. Maybe they should take a year off, or they should have some kind of a plan where they can focus on doing something that they like to do, where they can control their environment. Or maybe it's kind of a going back to older systems, maybe colonial times, where a young person could become an apprentice to a carpenter or a plumber or some, you know, have some job where they can function doing simple chores without a lot of interaction with people, where they can feel a sense of accomplishment, they can make some money, they can do something repetitive, which I think is good psychologically, and maybe work it through that way over years. And just but the point is that school may not be for them. School is not necessarily for everyone.
Well, I think what you've described is the fact that a one-size-fits-all school is definitely not for everyone. And, you know, I think it's going to take creative solutions to solve the problem.
752.
Chuck Morse speaks.
Thank you very much. My guest is Liza Long. She's the author of The Price of Silence, A Mom's Perspective on Mental Illness. Liza, I think that the growth of mental illness in our young people is the result of certain new educational approaches that have been introduced since the 1960s. And specifically, I think that there have been people, particularly a certain Harvard professor whose name escapes me right now, who have linked the teaching of reading as a as look-say, as opposed to a phonetic language, as something that has affected young people, that's led to things like dyslexia, maybe ADD, and other things, because a young person cannot read properly, and if they can't read properly, then it creates dissonance. Did your son read properly? Did he learn how to read right? Was he a good reader?
My son is an excellent reader. He's an excellent writer. He does have a learning disability called dysgraphia, which is it means he can't form letters. So he can't write his name, but he can keyboard just fine. He's actually written a book, so he writes well, he reads well.
And he did he learn how to read phonetically, do you know?
Yes. Yeah. We did.
He did. Okay.
We learned. Yes. Yeah. So, but I agree. I mean,
because
you know, you touch on some challenges because, you know, we can look for so many causes and there are so many things that have changed, but we do know, I'm intrigued by what you said, because we do know, for example, that the way we can really see ADHD is by looking at the way the brain talks to itself. So it's in the, you know, it's in the neurons. I talked to some neuroscientists when I researched the book, and they showed me brain scans, and they showed me what an ADHD brain looks like. And there's a difference in the way those connections are made between parts of the brain when compared to a neurotypical kid, a normal kid. So we can definitely see these things in the brain, and it's intriguing to me that you mentioned that study.
Right, and I think that there are certain modalities of teaching that changed, mostly in the 1960s and 70s, and I think that you can connect those to this increase in not just mental illness, but depression and suicide and all of it. Children, and the other thing that I'd bring up, and this one, you know, may seem a little out in left field, but so be it, is that there's a lack and there's a loss of spirituality in the schools. People no longer believe in God. They believe in, moral relativism. They believe in evolution. They believe in atheism. And that
my family is religious, I have to say, and I do have to say it was a little bit. I went to my priest because someone actually suggested that I have our priest exorcise my son, and he just laughed. He said that's not going to cure your son's mental illness. And I think we have to be a little bit careful because I just want to stress, Chuck, I think all the comments you're making are true maybe about society as a whole, right? Maybe the loss of spirituality is hurting society as a whole. But when we are looking at mental illness, I think we need to remember that it is a brain disease. You know, the brain is an organ. It can get a disease just like the liver or the pancreas or the stomach. So those problems you bring up are certainly societal, but...
Well, but it is a brain disease, but yet it does seem to be, like other diseases, one that's on the increase, and we have to ask why. I don't think that, there's always been a mental illness, of course, goes back to the beginning of time, but there must be some kind of causal issue with regard to the increase of it starting, you know, maybe at, I don't know, 60s, 70s. And that it we should take a look at whether or not it's connected not just to education, but to the way our society approaches issues. Because I think that if you look at American society, like going back to the 1930s, and you look at schools, you didn't have this kind of depression. You didn't have this kind of mental illness. It was there, but it wasn't as big. It wasn't a growing thing. It was.
Maybe we just didn't talk about it, though. Chuck, maybe people just didn't talk about it. I mean, it's hard to say. And then when you look at prevalence, too, you could look at societal things. But in researching my book, I also found that even things like the prenatal environment, maybe things like processed foods will even be implicated in what causes those brain changes in children. So I think we have to be careful. We have to say, well, maybe because of stigma, people just didn't come forward. Or maybe because we put people in mental institutions, we weren't aware of the problem as a society. And now that people are in the community with us, we've got to find better solutions for kids and families. And I do stress that treatment absolutely can help children and families to lead normal, productive lives, which I think is the goal for all of us.
Right. No, I mean, you do make the point in that maybe back then people were taken out of the schools and put into mental institutions. So that's why everybody in the school was happier, because they didn't have, the other issue, we only have a minute or so left, is that I think that 9 out of 10 of the cases involving school shootings and violence, the kids involved in that were on some kind of psychotropic drug. And maybe it was misdiagnosed. Maybe it was, they were getting off of it too soon. But isn't there a connection there?
Well, there's a connection certainly if they go off the drugs. We know that. So yeah, the drug question is huge and definitely needs to be addressed.
Liza, thank you for joining me this afternoon. I think we've run out of time.
Thank you so much.
For Whole Blood, 25 people in Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut last year. That she's decrying the fact that when they listed the number of dead in that massacre, they did not include Adam Lanza and his mother. I mean, the mother is one thing because, she was, we don't know much about her other than that she kept a lot of guns in the house and was giving him training with guns, which I think was inappropriate. Not because I'm not a supporter of the Second Amendment. I am a vigorous supporter of the Second Amendment. But because, when you have somebody who's mentally unstable like Adam Lanza, and she knew he was, and who was prone to violence and delusional episodes, I don't think that it's kind of a no-brainer to suggest you don't teach that, you don't give this person access to guns. It's that simple. It's like... if somebody's obese, you don't bring in gigantic pieces of fudge and chocolate into the house either. I mean, you just, it didn't make a heck of a lot of sense. So in a sense, I think she does bear some responsibility there. But the main thing is that I do not think that Adam Lanza, the murderer, should be listed along with the victims. He was not the victim. He was the murderer. He was a mass murderer who shot down in cold blood, consciously and wittingly, 25 people. Students, children, teachers, and I don't care why he did it. I don't care if he was mentally ill or not. He was a murderer. He should not be listed among victims. He was not a victim. He was the perpetrator of those horrible crimes. So I don't think that he should be listed. I don't even think that we should mention his name publicly. It's like the guy that, I know this has been said about the person who assassinated John Lennon in 1970. We shouldn't give him, you know, there's an element to that where someone is crying out for attention. And they should, there's a narcissistic element. Somebody wants to be famous. We shouldn't give them any of that. They should not get any recognition at all. If he commits suicide, that's fine. But if he's alive, then he should be quietly put away somewhere where he should never be heard from again. Because to give someone like that attention encourages that in others who might have a propensity for that kind of behavior, I would say. It awards them. So I don't agree with Liza Long that he should have been listed because he's mentally ill. I don't think so. He should not have been in school if he was violent. I don't care why someone is violent. If they are violent, I don't want them in school putting young people or teachers or anyone else at risk. You know, and the fact that they are mentally ill, in a sense, makes it even worse. Because if they really are mentally ill, as that term is defined, then they don't even know what they're doing. Then they don't have a moral code which says that, you know, they're right or wrong. Of course, again, it's not as bad as a jihadist who starts, you know, knocking people off because they don't, you know, submit to the scimitar. But, you know, either way, they have no business being in school.
Chuck Morse speaks.
Thank you very much. And we're back. And I'm talking about the phenomena of violent mental illness in our society generally, amongst young people in schools. You know, it's a symptom, I think, of bigger problems. It's not to say that it hasn't happened in the past, but, Liza Long says that it did happen, but it wasn't discussed. I don't think I agree with that. I think that if someone in the 1930s or whenever in this country had murdered classmates like they do today, then it would have been discussed. These were extremely rare instances. I mean, there was one case, for example, in the early 1920s where the Leopold and Loeb case, where they murdered a classmate, and it was a huge national story that went on for a year. And the lawyer, their defense lawyer being Clarence Darrow, the famous ACLU lawyer, who devised a defense that basically said, well, they're just genetic, he said. Genetic? I don't think so. You know, we all have genetic predispositions to a lot of things, but violence is a choice. Do we have pre-existing conditions that would result in a brain disease? Perhaps. But, you know, especially in this day and age, Liza Long points out that it's treatable once it's properly diagnosed, as her son is treatable. And who is now functioning fine and back at school making friends, and he kind of is able to conduct his life with the right sort of medication. So I don't know. I mean, it seems to me that if that can happen for him, why it took 9 years for him to get treated, that to me is the problem we're looking at as a symptomatic question. Which is that if someone is mentally ill, or if they're behaving violently, the school and the city and the community would be well advised to get that person to first of all taken out of the school, so they're not putting anyone at risk, and then secondly treated properly to see if they can be handled, if they can handle their mental illness, and if they cannot, then they. Talking about the difficult topic of mental illness and the violence associated with it, I do think that, Liza Long talks about the getting rid of institutions, and that happened in the 1980s after a federal court decision, which basically forced the government to empty out the mental institutions across the United States. And mentally ill people were basically set out onto the streets. There was no more place for them. I don't know the details of that decision, but I think that it contributed to an increase in crime and homelessness and other miseries. That's not to say these mental institutions were good places either. I would think that there ought to be a place for the mentally ill who are not going to be functional to be housed. I don't think that's a big should be viewed as a big no-no. It's not like, one flew over the cuckoo's nest necessarily. There can be, some state involvement in monitoring these places to make sure that they are, reasonable, and you don't get too many sadists involved in them, like the nurse in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. But at the same time, you have people who cannot, for various reasons, or will not, however it came about, function in society and cannot have treatment. I've interviewed people who have had mental illness who get treatment. They get lithium, which, by the way, is a naturally occurring substance in water that seems to lift their spirits to the point where they can function normally. And if that be the case, then, hallelujah. I mean, it's not it doesn't have to be a super expensive treatment either. I would hope that in general, my suggestion to people who are mentally ill is to use controlled substances as a last resort, get therapy, get faith, make sure they read properly with phonetic reading, because reading is thinking, and reading is organizing your imagination properly. And that can, I think, increase a person's sense of autonomy and self-worth. I do think that this should, you talk about a stigma for people who are mentally ill. I think this should not be a stigma for people who don't go to school. We have a stigma in the society, especially coming from liberals, with regard to people not only who don't go to school, but who don't go to college, who have blue-collar jobs, who have trades. Oh, they have nothing but scorn for working people. I would think that we should have a renaissance of people who have trades and who are able to function in that sort of context, because to my way of thinking, learning a trade is something that someone who has mental issues that they can do. I think of this case, this was mental retardation, but I remember back in the day when I was when I taught music, I had a student who has mental retardation. He lived in a home that was run by a church, by the way, privately. And given his limited mental capacity, he had a job. His job was assembling boxes and putting things in boxes. It was a very simple manual job that required a limited amount of mental capacity. And he loved his job. He loved going there. I never saw someone more enthusiastic about his job. It was like SpongeBob SquarePants, he loved his work, which is very inspiring to me. And he loved getting his paycheck. He loved paying me for his guitar lesson. He loved having a little cash. He loved his life because he found something that he could do that made him feel like, and he was contributing to the world. He was, we need someone to put these goods inside these boxes. And he got a sense of self-worth that can only come from work, from doing something productive, from contributing to society, and from getting financial benefit that is agreed upon from that contribution that, from the company. I would think that the same phenomena could exist for someone who is violently mentally ill. We don't have to keep them in school if they're that unhappy there, where they're putting other people at risk, where they're requiring all this attention and this huge expense in terms of special education. I would think that they could get some kind of a trade that would be commensurate to, I think that a lot of the mental and emotional problems that our young people are experiencing are the result of deliberate policies and agendas that are foisted upon them by our schools and those who run them. And when I say those who run them, I don't mean the teachers or the principals. I mean the educrats at places like the Carnegie Endowment for Teaching and the National Department of Education, who are turning our schools from a place where a young person learns how to think on their own cognitively into these sort of behaviorist factories where children are treated like guinea pigs in a social experiment. The result is social discord and even mental illness. If it's genetic, I think we may all have, you know, we all are dealing with emotional issues. That's part of being alive. Depression is normal from time to time. So is mania. But the question is, what is it about someone where they become unable to function? I don't think it's genetic. It may be. There may be a propensity genetically. But ultimately, I think it is something that's it's more behavioral in nature. And the proof is that, in a sense, Liza Long's son is being treated properly with the right medication. So he no longer functionally has mental illness, at least in his daily life. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's a complicated question. It's one that I'm going to be delving into. And in the coming months and years. And I'm looking forward to doing other programs on this topic. So anyway, I want to thank you all for listening this afternoon. You're listening to the Information Radio Network. This is Chuck Morse. Check out my blog site, Chuck Morse Speaks. And thanks so much, and have a good day, everybody.